Hello, motion picture brains. That's you. Fans of light, darkness, composition, celluloid, zeros, and ones. Welcome back to another episode of the Through the Lens podcast, the unedited audio of our full conversation with a cinematographer. In this episode, we spoke with the legendary Prince of Darkness, Mr. Gordon Willis, who is known for, well, I could go on here, but he's known for just about everything. He's known for The Godfather Part 2, The Godfather Part 3. He is known for shooting, I believe, 7 or 8 films with Woody Allen, including Annie Hall, Manhattan, Zelig, Stardust Memories, Interiors, several others. He's also known for shooting with Alan J. Pakula, including Clute, All the President's Men, The Devil's Own, and many other films that were also fabulous. He's also shot films in the 80s that were really underrated, like Bright Lights, Big City. He also shot a comedy called The Money Pit with Tom Hanks and Shelley Long, if memory serves. But more importantly, he is credited with being fundamentally the godfather of modern cinematography. He basically rewrote the book on what it meant to shoot, to light, and to compose a film. What follows after this verbose introduction is the uncut audio of my conversation with Gordon. We met him at his home in the Maritimes in around November of 2012. And we have to thank him for being courteous and opening his doors to us. He was unbelievably welcoming, had donuts for us, which we didn't eat, had coffee for us, which we didn't drink, not because we wanted to be ungracious, but only because we were too busy just being in awe of the man. And I want to say, also in this long introduction, I'd like to say that sometimes, you know, you get it in your head that something's going to be so great and wonderful, and your expectations kind of blow out of proportion. So I didn't know if when I went to meet with Gordon Willis whether or not it was going to be, you know, one of these things where it was, you know, he's just going to be an old crotchety guy with not much interesting to say or what, because he is such a legend. Well, this was one of these times where the expectations were exceeded, where the experience lived beyond what you were anticipating. He was so phenomenally interesting and clear and poignant, just absolutely poignant with everything he had to talk about with photography, that it amazed me. I was mesmerized by him for about, you know, 2 hours, hour and a half, 2 hours. As you'll see here, it was really just fantastic speaking with him, and we're much in his debt for his time. We're trying to organize more interviews where I can go even more in depth with him, because his memory is so sharp and his thoughts are so clear on why he made every choice he made when he was a photographer, cinematographer. So, but we're not sure how that's going to play out, when the timing and what works for him and all that stuff. So enjoy what's here. If you want to check out the Hollywood video version of this interview, you will find it at crafttrek.com as season 1, I believe episodes 8 and 9, or no, 9 and 10 of Through the Lens, or youtube.com/crafttrek. You can also subscribe if you want to be favorable. It should be noted that during this interview, Gordon Willis pulled out a gun, shot me in the face, and blood started pouring out of my eye socket through my glasses.
Oh yeah, the Red Bull thing, yeah. The Red Bull funded thing. So what happened? Did he live?
Yeah, he made it.
He free fall for you were talking about it before you guys got here.
Broke the speed of sound.
Five minutes, 700 miles an hour, or something like that. Broke the speed of sound.
Whoa!
And then, you know, parachute opened and he landed on his feet.
That's insane.
Yeah.
No, it was pretty cool. We saw the helmet cam footage.
Yeah, POV. That is amazing.
We have a.
I was ask why somebody wants to do that.
What did we have? 85.
But I have an 85, 50.
Everybody needs their own thing.
Let me grab the 50 prime and give that to Jeff.
If you really wanted to do, he should have a little pressure suit for his dog or something, and it would help.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, great. That's the thing. The dog.
Like, thinking of marketing.
Well, Hollywood market. I mean, dogs are eating and living better than people now, so why not have a dog involved?
Yeah. And your point is?
Okay, I think we should let it roll.
Yep, we're going to roll in 2 seconds.
One, two.
The compliment was taken away right there, pal.
Okay. So you have the daughter now. Do you have any pets to go with it?
No, I'm not a pet guy. My wife's not a... I happen to be married to a bit of a saint. And she's really... Well, she puts up with me, which is number one, and yeah. I'm saying that only half jokingly, and then on top of that, she's great.
Good. Where are you living in Toronto? Right in the middle of Toronto, or you're outside?
Right in the Jewish ghetto. So the equivalent would be Flatbush or Borough Park. Or,
oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. Not Williamsburg, but...
Right. I shot a movie there, and I enjoyed it. I shot a movie called Paper Chase there with John.
It's funny, because I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah.
So you shot...
you can ask me about it right now. Yeah.
No, but I mean, it was... So that the opening shot where it's just the kids streaming into the classroom, what... wait. Oh, you can fold.
That's a...
Wow.
It was a close call. You got another one though, right?
I think Gordon was really phased.
That was a set, and
that was a set.
All the schoolroom was a set. There was a set that was put together in a studio called Kleinberg Studios, which was outside of Toronto.
That's and, going back in the
Kleinberg's where they built the Oval Office set now, CineSpace Studio.
CineSpace, yeah.
Okay, well, that's where this Harvard Law School, we built that there. So. And then her house was on a street in...
Jeff, move forward and back. Just...
Right.
All right. You'll have tons of range, so just try and...
I'll keep it right here, actually.
So anyway, it was all in Toronto, actually.
Did you like it? Did you like shooting in Toronto?
I enjoyed the town. It's very nice. And the crews were very limited at that point, but I had a good crew, so it was like... It was okay.
This was, it must have been 70?
It was in the 70s, or early 80s or late 70s. I can't remember which now.
Okay, but it was after you were already...
Yeah, right. And, yeah. And,
that's amazing.
It was so fun.
Where are you?
Okay, so I have a really verbose introduction. It's obnoxiously verbose. So we'll cut it down after.
Yeah.
I blurted it out.
Yeah. So I liked it up there. I was having a good time. I'm trying, the hotel we stayed at was something Arms. Something.
Oh, the Windsor Arms.
The Windsor Arms.
Oh, that was a very nice hotel.
Very nice hotel.
Yeah.
Small, not too crazy, and you know, nice rooms and things.
I've noticed two schools of cinematographers when it comes to mingling work with family. There's the ones that are like basically, are we rolling?
Yeah.
Fabulous. There's the ones that are basically like, I need to adjust. Take less movies or do whatever, have to spend more time with my family and my kids. And those are the ones that are just like going, you know,
right,
knees to the wall, just nonstop trying to, you know.
Right.
Did you very consciously try and adjust your working schedule when you were?
No. And the reason I say no was that I always thought I was lucky to have a job, you know what I'm saying? So when one job would go away, there's always a certain amount of terror in your heart that nobody's going to call me and I'm never going to get another job again. You know, that kind of thing. Actors say that too.
Oh, actors say it all the time. Yeah. But you actually felt that way.
Well, I felt that way. There was one point I was shooting like 1.5 or 2 features a year at one point. And you don't think about it when you're doing it. But I've also had like 6 months off. You know, without any shooting at all. And
and the phone isn't ringing for you even? I mean, you're, you know, one of the...
No, that was early on, of course.
I see.
But still, even though you have those experiences, but I tell you what happens. When you do certain kinds of movies with certain kinds of people in a certain kind of way, you automatically separate yourself from the business as a whole. So you're not on the list to say... Call so, and then him too. You're not on the list.
Right.
So you get on.
You've niched yourself or whatever.
So you get on a list of, or with people who actually want to do certain kinds of movies in a certain kind of way.
Right.
Or they want a lot of input, and they want, you know, someone who helps define their movie.
Right.
As opposed to, get me somebody. I want to get out of here on Friday and Saturday, and we have to be done in 8 weeks. I've shot those too, but that's right. Not why they usually did not hire me for that.
You
know.
They hired you to be an artist.
To design the movie.
Design the movie, okay.
Yeah, structurally or visually, at any rate. But all the directors that I worked with received and took in a lot of input, wanted a lot of input. And
I just want to say input. Are we talking about blocking? Are we talking about the performances? Are we talking about the script? Are we talking about cutting? And you know, like, is it minutia or is it macro? Or is it all of the above?
It's all the above except the acting part. You know, I never dealt with that. Although I had good relationships with actors, I never got entangled up with that. And of course, I never get tangled up with the editing after the fact.
Right.
But in order to shoot, you have to know how to cut in order to shoot well. But all of the...
Just to say that again to the camera there.
Right. Well,
no. Because just so that people know.
No. In order to shoot, you really have to know how to cut.
Right.
You know, otherwise, you're shooting a lot of stuff. And it's a lesson for directors, which I wish more of them would learn. You know, you don't need the cut of the doorknob and the cut of the window and the cut of medium shot, long shot, close-up, over the shoulder song. That's dump truck directing, what I call it. They take all the stuff and then they throw it into the editorial room and the editor fashions the movie. Well, I never functioned that way.
So then instead of dump truck directing, how would you define the version of that? What's the version where it's not about just getting more and more and more? It's about putting pieces together that will... Is that what it is? Putting pieces together that will elegantly cut together and that tell the story properly? Or how would you define it?
Yeah, that's basically it. But what you do is... But I'll just take a mythical movie here that we're working on, right? Okay. You read the script, you break down the script in your own mind, you go over it carefully with the director to see what he wants.
Yep.
Some directors don't want to do that at all. But finally, what it boils down to is you walk into the first set of the day or whatever it happens to be.
Yep.
And what I do is, you have, let's say, two pages, one of them. You say, well, how's the scene going to work? How many cuts do we need to make it work? What's the scene all about? And blah, blah, blah. And it may turn out that one cut does the whole scene effectively now. This is not has nothing to do with economics. Or you may need three cuts, or you may need four cuts.
So an example would be, I know we're talking mythical, but let's to get real into the practical.
Yeah.
Manhattan,
right.
Woody and Diane walking down the street and at walk and talk.
Right.
I don't know if it was Steadicam or handheld. I can't remember that clearly, but it would have been early days with Steadicam. And you just carry the whole scene into the convenience store where he gets something and she gets something. And this is the first time we see them actually, like, starting to, you know, like there's friction between them and now all of a sudden they're starting to flirt a little bit.
Right, which leads into the shot of the bridge at the end. Yeah. Well,
thank you.
That sequence was put together before we started shooting it.
Yeah.
And so all those cuts were up here and what he said before, because we discussed it, you know. So.
But it's basically a one-er, right? I mean, it's basically...
Well, the one on the street is where they're walking and talking.
And then we finish, and then there's a few
then
cuts.
Then we cut into the store with a coffee, and we cut into the... But we actually did that cut twice on the street at night because, I mean, we had to go back and do it again because he wasn't happy with something with the dialogue. But that's another kind of person, Woody Allen. He's a performer as well, so... A lot of actors or a lot of performers feel a lot more comfortable doing one piece. In other words, if it lasts two blocks or a half a block, right? Cough the whole thing up in one take because their timing and their acting, etc., works better for them.
Right.
And other cases, it's not a good idea because you really have to cut a performance and you need two pieces. But I love those shots because it takes a long time to set them up, but actually it works effectively in the end because when you start shooting, goes fast, you know.
Uh-huh.
So it's like...
And how much setup is... I mean, I keep on meaning I want to go and do the introduction here, and but I like where this is going, so I'm just want to... So, but how... I mean, how much setup was... I mean... I'm stumbling over the question because this is one of the questions I wanted to ask you. Annie Hall, right, is known for being this movie. Annie Hall is known for being this movie where DPs around the world say, it looks like it's not lit. Do you realize how hard that is to do? Right? And...
Well, that's a, okay. It's an example. It's a poor example in my mind. It's a poor example in my mind, but I'm glad they feel that way. You know, I mean, a large percentage of my movies look that way. You know,
no question.
Okay, but I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, not at all. I mean, we're talking about one of the greatest movies ever made. A movie that many people can watch over and over and over again. And it is so committed to this guy's disastrous relationships and the humor and the ridiculousness of every situation he gets into. And I guess my question is, you know, with the walk and talk with him and Robbins going down the street, you know, Jew, you know, and it starts, they're probably, you know, that big in the frame and then slowly they come into it and we track with them.
Right.
Are there lights there?
No.
I mean, how do you deal with maybe the eye sockets?
I mean, you have to see what you're looking at,
right?
First of all, I don't shoot by habit. If you know, it works that way. I mean, that was my idea. So let's just do it in one. We'll stuff you way up the street, and we'll hear you to begin with, and then you'll materialize. You know, and no, there are no lights there. There are no lights under the marquee where these two guys are saying, you know...
Hey, I'll be singer. This is half the cast of The Godfather.
None of that. There's no lighting until I get into the...
When he's walking across the street and saying, how do you do it while I'm boring and she's boring too, and talking to, you know, is there any...
Inside the lobby there's some lighting, but most exteriors... I don't say I never do it, but in that particular case, I rarely put anything up.
What would you do? I mean, would you do something if, let's say, the eye sockets were dark or something? Would you just add makeup, or would you add a reflector? I mean, I know I'm getting really specific, but I just want to know.
What if? The problem is that you ultimately, if somebody looks bad,
right.
And you work on the flat side of the street, you know, you're out of the sun and everything. If they look bad, you're not going to do much to fix it. What I usually do is I'll do certain odds and ends within the camera to make things a little bit better for them. But the truth of the matter is, you can't fix that. So in old school Hollywood terms, you know, they'd stuff an arc up somebody's ass and turn it on, you know. And they didn't really care about the continuity of the story, you know, long as, you know, everybody looked great. So, and they were good at it because it all looked that way. Right. So it was very, you know.
Make sure the filter's on for the close-up of the girl. Yeah, she's the star.
You know, so... You know, they dropped stainless steel in front of Doris Day and, you know, Rock Hudson had something else and they had a lot of lights and, you know, but it all melted together. So it worked. I can't do things like that or I didn't want to.
Okay, well, this is all coming to a beautiful, so I just want to start over, but we're using all of this. So.
Right. Mm-hmm.
By the way, one of the things we do is we are uploading the podcast, the audio part of it, uncut.
Okay.
So any swear words you make will be heard by millions. Welcome back to crafttruck.com and our series Through the Lens. Over the past 120 years, the institution, medium, and business of film has seen many masterful artists. Known to the masses typically are the writers, the directors, the producers, and the stars. But sometimes a craftsman, a costume designer, an editor, a cinematographer, for example, will transcend the practice and leave their stamp on the medium. And we're sitting with one such person today. A man that has a career spanned at least three legendary directors, half a dozen masterpieces, and I mean masterpieces, not hits or blockbusters, but rather masterpieces, a dozen or so great films, the godfather of modern cinematography. When DPs around the world are asked, who is your favorite? Who influenced you the most? The name that resoundingly comes out, almost universally first, Mr. Gordon Willis. Thank you for being here.
Oh, delighted. Throw mud at people now?
Or... yeah, well, that was my next step.
Yeah, right.
It's been a pleasure. It's fun. Yeah. So I just want to talk a little bit about something we have to get out of the way.
Yeah.
You look at the history of film.
Right.
The images.
Right.
There's some extremely memorable images from cinema history.
Yeah.
Some examples, the sled at the end of Kane, the cat buzzing around the shoe of Lime in The Third Man, Dorothy and her friend skipping down the yellow brick road, the split face in Persona, the shot of Marlon Brando at the beginning of The Godfather with dark pools under his eyes and a man being asked essentially for blood justice.
Right.
Did you know when you were making that movie, did you know that you were making history? I mean, was it clear that this was...
Basically, you don't know any of those things when you're working. I mean, what you do is focus up on what it is you're doing and do what you want to do to make what you're doing at that moment work.
Right.
You have no idea whether anything is going to be, you know... put together, mounted on the wall, and turn into some sort of, you know, piece that everybody hangs on to for the rest of their life. I've never thought of anything as being iconic. Usually if somebody finishes a movie and says, this is the greatest movie we ever made, we had a great time, usually a piece of junk because they were too busy having a good time. You know? But I would say no. I mean, I didn't. No, I mean, I think it's very good for a director to run around and saying, this is fabulous, you know. But truth of the matter is, nobody really knows.
Right. Yeah. Until it's up on the screen.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
What was so innovative about that shot? What, I mean, if can I ask Gordon Willis to analyze what Gordon Willis brought to this medium? Because everyone knows that things didn't look the way they looked before you came along.
Right.
But... can you explain that in simple terms, what you're doing? I mean, the easy answer is my understanding, it's a wide, big, top soft, top source of light, but I don't know.
Well, you're looking for the formula. You
know, uh-huh.
There is no formula. The formula comes out of you. So whether it's a top light or whether it's some other thing, it just happened to be that's what was necessary to do this particular movie or this particular scene. So I did it. Bottom line is the design behind all of that, or the thinking behind the design of all of that,
yes,
came out of Marlon Brando, because Marlon had this makeup stuff that he was using. So top light seemed to be the most effective way of dealing with him. You don't really want to see his eyes. There was a big Hollywood rush about you can't see his eyes. That's right, you can't. Until it was revealed a little bit later, it began opening things up a bit. But so he didn't really know what he was thinking about, you know, all the time. So the essence of top lighting for that movie was him. So, but you can't just do it for him. You have to extend it into the whole feel of the movie. So that's what I did. But that, and the principle idea in this first was to start in this cave-like environment, this blackness, and slowly begin to reveal it and then pop around, and there he is. The essence of this kind of bottom feeder in this room cut against this wedding that was going on the outside. So we had this juxtaposition of this bright hysteria, all these Italians with their food, wedding cakes arriving, mm-hmm, blah, blah, blah. And you cut back to the room, and we're back in this kind of
cave
hole. Right. So that was the principle of the opening of the movie. But the rest of the movie was hung on the same lighting structure. It was overhead lighting. But it's also, you know, it was 20 minutes before the movie started, I decided what to do. And I was thinking about it for so long. So it was only about 20 minutes before the movie started that I decided how the movie ultimately should look overall. So
you were considering other options, a hard side, or I don't know. What
the, I was deciding now. I don't even think that way. I was thinking, what should this film look like?
Yeah.
From a story point of view. Yeah. Craft, you have to know your craft in order to define an idea, in order to take something and put it up on the screen. If you don't have any craft, you can't do that.
Right.
So if you have a lot of craft, it sets you free to put things together the way you want them. So I just think about what it should look like.
Look like, right.
And I don't care what anybody else did. I'll do what I think is appropriate for the movie. The movie. You know, I'll do whatever I think is appropriate for the movie.
To tell the story.
To tell the story,
right.
Exactly. And a lot of women didn't like it in the business. They would say, oh, God, he's not so good with women, which wasn't true.
With lighting women?
No, with lighting women, but which wasn't true. But women would take a bath lighting-wise with me if they're in the middle of something in a scene and the story became more important than how do I look. So they'd have to. But when it was important, I fixed it, you know. But
fixed it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
They'd look good.
Yeah. Interesting turn of phrase.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I see what you're saying. Well, I appreciate you edifying, you know, like, you don't, that's not the way you think. Like, you're saying, no. What's the formula? There is no formula.
There is no formula.
Yeah. You know?
But everybody tried to get the formula. Because everybody says, I got a call from somebody who was a famous DP at that point. He says, I got a call. Somebody wants to shoot this movie and they want it to look like The Godfather. What did you do?
I'm sorry.
That was my reaction on the telephone.
Right. I shot the movie.
I said, I can't really tell you that. They said, well, there are no secrets in this business. I said, no, there aren't. I said, but I can't. There's no way I can explain this to you because there is no process. There is no formula, you know.
You can't tell us who that DP was?
Yeah, I can't, you know.
Can you tell us who that DP was or no?
No.
Okay, fair enough.
Yes. Go on now, anyway.
Let's go back to your beginnings because this is mm-hmm. Okay, so this is what I'd like to know. Who influenced Gordon Willis? And I'm talking about whether it's art, visual art, photographers, mm-hmm. the movies that you saw as a kid. I mean, where, at what point, just tell us about you growing up and deciding to get into movies and how it, into camera and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Actually, for the most part, I wasn't, I didn't really want to be a DP. When I was little, I grew up with my father, who was a makeup man at Warner's on the East Coast during the Depression. They had a big studio in Brooklyn, and he used to take me out there. I used to hang out. So I've sort of always been around the business, so to speak. But when I was young, I wanted to be an actor, actually. Thank God I didn't do that. It's more death-defying than being a DP or anything else in the business. So I didn't do that, but I got interested in stills, shot stills for a long time. Not productively, not for money. I just did it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Ended up costing my family a lot of money while I just kept shooting stills.
What were you shooting stills of? Just street photography or?
Anything that interested me. Then I thought, oh, gee, I like fashion. Maybe I could get involved with that. So I had girlfriends that would get me models that were working kids, you know, 15, 16, or 17 type models, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd do free shots for them if they, you know, hung out and posed for me. So that's how that worked. And then pretty soon that didn't really interest me finally. But then I cut all the nonsense out of it. I finally went into the service and I got into a motion picture unit in the service
mm-hmm.
and a documentary unit. And worked there and then got out. And then
where did you serve?
I served in three or four places. That was during the Korean thing. I was in Mountain Home, Idaho. I was in Florida. And I was in California.
Mm-hmm.
And I never went overseas. I was fortunate. I didn't get tangled up in that. So I used a lot of government time and money and film and everything to learn.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought I did. Then when I got out, I realized I didn't know much because then I had to get a job. My wife and I were here in New York, and I had no job. Yeah. So the bottom line of it, I got into the union, the East Coast union at that point. L.A. and the East Coast were separated. They weren't really. But and then I had to work my way up. You know, I started as an assistant and blah, blah, blah. I ran into a lot of very nice people, actually, for the most part, at that point in my life. So,
what did you pick up while you were assisting? Did you see things and go, "This can be better. I can change this," or was it?
No, I never really looked at. I never really dealt with photography. What was going from aesthetic point of view?
Right.
I was busy learning an awful lot about mechanics, technical stuff, and learning to be a good assistant and all that kind of stuff. Uh-huh. And then of course you pick up all this stuff from working with different cameramen about how to do this and how to do that and how to do that and how to do this, all of which was useful at one level or another, but most of it was trashed in my mind when I started working, but not at first. The first thing everybody does when they start is they start doing what they've seen other people do.
Right.
Which is generally...
mimicry.
And it's mostly not good. You know, uh-huh. So, once you push past that, and you start looking at things and say, "No, I think this should be. This should look like. And what about just one light bulb on, and they're moving across the window and over here against the line, and then back off? That would be good. Well, it's good for you. Looks great on the screen because everyone who's paying for this,
the Willies,
yes, they got major coronaries going on. I mean, the first week of The Godfather, when you were the opening scene with this guy in this room, it was like.
Did you have to get on the phone? Did your agent have to get on the phone?
No, I got with the producer was running. He says, is this too dark? And so I said, no. I said, it's not too dark.
Is Bob Evans you're talking about?
No, not Bob. He was out. This is Al Ruddy, who was a good guy. Okay. So he's talking to these guys out there. I said, no. I said, you know, when you make a cut, you don't make a cut so that you can linger on this cut. This cut is designed to work either ahead or back of or next to other cuts. So I said, you have to think of it in terms of everything. I said, when you see the rest of it that goes with this, I think you'll feel better about it. This is how you have to explain everything, you know, because that's, you work in a hallway with nothing but a lot of dark cuts of people firing guns at each other, and you send that all to California. I said, what's happening? You know, we don't.
We can't tell the story, Gordon.
Yeah,
right. What's going on?
Yeah. So that's the first reaction.
So you're referring to the hospital sequence.
Yeah, or anything. Anything you shoot in any movie.
Right.
Yeah, not only that one. But so anyway, essentially, you know,
that's amazing. So
restart.
Sure, no problem. Right. They have a maximum of 29 minutes.
Yeah, right.
Well, Mr. Willis, I just wish you were a little more clear.
Those specifics.
No, this is fabulous. It's fabulous. Because you're answering the question so elegantly, eloquently.
That's always good to hear.
Well, it's true. Are we good?
Yep, we're just going to roll the last camera, and we're going to be... You may continue.
Okay, so were you determined to, quote-unquote, you know, change the game? You kind of already answered this. You said that, you know, you start off mimicking other people. You start off doing what you've seen before, and then you evolve into your own thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you've answered this yet. Who are your biggest, who are the guys that you admired the most that you said, wow, you know, what that guy does blows me away. Like I, or that person, you know.
Well, I'd rather answer that question by saying, I won't give you a specific name, mm-hmm. but what I did do, which I became very enamored of and began to fall in love with actually, was I'd go to the movies. I grew up in the movies. I was always watching movies.
Uh-huh. You know,
I loved to go to the movies. But there was
favorite film of all time?
No.
Can't name one?
No.
Okay.
Pieces. Take pieces of a lot of movies and right. cut them all together. I began to enjoy like great black and white movies on the screen, you know. I mean, if you showed me a whole pile of names, I could say, oh yeah, he, you know, he was like, but, and I began to find out about these movies, you know, what they did. I became very interested in this and very, and so I loved black and white movies, and I still do. I still dig back into 40s and 50s and 30s mm-hmm. movies. I still enjoy
Golden
them.
Golden Age.
And I liked everything that I just liked, you know. So most of what I drew, most of what I learned about cutting movies, by the way, how to put movies together, I learned from watching movies.
Right.
And you learn a lot if you watch movies that were made in the 30s or 40s.
Yep.
You'll see a shot of two people arguing or talking about making love. Bum. Head to head. It goes on for 5 minutes. There's no cut in it. You know, it plays really well. So why would you cut? Right. Or they use one cut at the end as a button, and that's it. So I learned a lot about that kind of structure from watching a lot of earlier directors and earlier DPs. But I am nobody that I thought was, although there were several out there, you know, that I enjoyed. But I think if I think back on it, I enjoyed black and white movies more than a lot of color movies. Color, when you work in color, it's a burden. You have to deal with color. If you don't deal with it, it turns into, you know, something awful.
This is what I think in the movie Visions of Light, which you were also in, they talk about this. They talk about the fact that there's this term, which I don't really understand, where they'll say cinematography is always 30 years behind where it should be, because the minute they were starting to master, you know, this frame, it got wide. And then when it got wide, they added color.
Right.
And now they're adding 3D. And it's constantly, you know, going to these. Are these extra elements burden? Like, I mean, do they just make it harder and harder to tell?
Well, they are a burden because the major problem with all of this is that, well, I think color is a burden because, as I said, you have to deal with it. You can't just let everybody put everything on they want and paint the walls that you got. Yeah, it has to be coordinated and focused. Otherwise, you know, it looks like an explosion at a Sherwin-Williams store. I mean, so you've got to be careful, you know.
Right.
But the rest of it, usually it's a disease that springs up in the business because nobody's going. You know, nobody wants to see it. Well, how come? Well, it's not wide enough, you know, or it's not big enough, or it doesn't have... All those things are really, in my mind, not the real reason. The real reason is there's no narrative.
Right. The story's not engaging.
Yeah, there's not nobody compelling. Wants to, you know, think, you know.
So let's talk a bit about movies today, because you said to me earlier, like, you know, I'll just give back to you what you told me. You said nobody takes a simple idea and just develops it. You know, they got to try and...
Yeah. Well, the general... We're in a world now and in a business where people perceive complexity as good. It's not good. Complexity is not good. People don't understand the elegance of simplicity. There are very few people left that do understand it. I mean, the whole idea is if you take a sophisticated idea, reduce it to the simplest possible terms so that it's accessible to everybody. And don't get simple mixed up with simplistic. That's not it. It's how you mount and present something that makes it engaging.
Can you define difference between simple and simplistic in your mind?
Well, simplistic is doing it badly. You know, I mean, you know, if you hit somebody in the pie face with a pie. I mean, don't. You know, that's simplistic. Simple is your choices. You know, it's what, you know, one light coming through a window might be quite beautiful. That's all you need. You don't need six other lights, because why are you doing all of this? By habit or by need, you know. It's the same thing in telling a story, or it's the same thing in making cuts within the structure of the story. So usually what happens now is they'll take a simple standalone idea and tie it into knots, you know, until nobody knows what the hell's going on.
Right.
And, you know, as long as they blow up something every 20 minutes. And I thought, well, this is terrible in movies. The real problem, though, is I started looking back at some television now, and I always liked GBH and PBS television, etc.
Yep.
And I always liked Masterpiece Theater and a lot of other things they do. And recently, within the last few years, they're not good. This is in my opinion. And the reason they're not good is they lack definition. They start writing and typing and talking a thing, and then pretty soon you know, all these people are showing up, all these other stories are showing up, all these other characters are walking through the door, they've forgotten which way they're going, and nobody knows what's going on. Right.
So they're not actually playing out the drama that they're
starting. And what happens is the mystery that you happen to be watching becomes not a mystery within the structure of the story, but becomes a mystery to you. What is this we're watching? I need more coffee and get up and leave. So I find it a big problem with complex, you know, not understanding, you know, the elegance of simplicity.
Yeah.
Not dealing with things properly.
Well, it's interesting to say this. One of the, let's just talk about simplicity for a second.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is a fair comparison. I don't know if it's a little bit silly, but you know, everyone talks about the brilliant shot. Not everyone. A lot of people talk about the brilliant shot from Conrad Hall Sr. in Cold Blood, the rain coming down the face, right, and doing the crying for the actor.
Right.
I compare that to personally my favorite shot that you lensed that I can think of off the top of my head, which is the single on Fonda at the end of Clute,
right,
when she's sitting in the office,
right,
dim. Everyone has left this textile plant, and the killer's there playing
right.
her the recording of
right.
what she's been trying
right.
to forget, which
right.
is her being beaten
right.
several
right.
years previous.
She starts crying. Yeah.
And that, to me, is, I actually, yes, in this case, the actor did the crying as opposed to the lighting doing the crying. But to me, that moment is absolutely, you know, it's breathtaking. You know, is it,
yeah, it's good. And I'm glad to see it that way because, yes, it's. When you do something, you want it to. Well, you want it to define the moment, not overrun the moment, so to speak. In that particular case, I know you bring that up. We shot that and. The way it was laid out, the way I laid it out was the head end of the scene when she's looking at him, she's looking left to right. Mm. Charles Durning was on the right side of the screen.
Yes.
And then I can't remember exactly, but at any rate, I made sure that the exit was made to turn her head so that she was in a specific place. So when she was crying, you could see what was going on. You know, with that pulled her around this way. So
I think she's looking left to right.
Yeah, I can't remember. It might have been left to right. Right. Yeah. I have to look again. But anyway, but when Daly's first hit the screen. She was looking at a point where you couldn't quite see it, you know. And she says, "You can't see anything." I said, "Yes, you can. Hang on a second here." So, you know, we got her around so that at the moment that was really important when she really started running, you know, we saw it very clearly. So, but that's another thing you have to think of: what it is you want to see, you know, uh-huh. and when you want to see it. I like that moment a lot, actually.
So on the lines of what you want to see when you want to see it, is an apocryphal story about Woody and you sitting in a room. I think it was for Manhattan. It may have been Stardust or something. And him saying, "Gordon, you can't see the actors." To which you said, "Yeah, but don't worry, you can hear them."
Well, that was based on us doing a piece in Manhattan where he and Keaton are in her apartment. I think they came into her apartment after a walk around the room, thing, and he's whining about getting something. I can't remember what. And we were talking about the blocking. I said, "Well, all right, you know, let her deliver this, and you leave, and then you know, she leaves, you come back in, you deliver it, so that the scene is moving this way." I said, which they picked up on, and we used it a lot of other times too. But he said, "Yeah, but I'll be off screen. You won't see me." I said, "Yeah, but they'll hear you." And it was, the light bulb went off in his head, and he thought, oh, this is great. You know, I can, you know. And it was better, actually, to do it that way than to be nose to nose on the scene.
Right.
So,
this also influenced the later scenes where, I think it was Manhattan, where, you know, we're looking down the hallways at split offices.
Oh, one's way down at one end of the hallway. And yeah, well, I was designed to put this kind of space between these two people while they were, talking.
Driving down the hallway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Genius.
And I, same way with the apartment. And
well, are we talking about the split screen, though? Not split screen, but basically the two sets?
You're talking about the Hemingway one where she's
She's in the couch and he's...
Right.
So the way that was explained to us in our film class, for what it's worth, from a professor who actually knew what he was talking about, was that he said she's in a world of comedies in the 30s, or... 30s, 40s, and he's in the noir world of the 30s, 40s, and he's going to pull her into his world, into this entrapping. Was any of that conscious, or was it all just, you know, it worked?
No, I walked into the room, the location we were going to shoot in, and I said, gee, this is great. I said, how would you like to do this in one piece so that we can, would she enjoy doing things in one piece? Like,
right.
I said, look at the way this is laid out. So I said, you stuff her over there and you're over here. And I said, you can just unbutton things as you come down the steps and then finally end up over here. I said, it would be very nice presentation on the scene. So, you know, I set it up. It was like perfect, you know, to work that way. So
it's a perfect shot.
Yeah, and I said, then when you come down, you got to hit the light on the way down here on this side and then continue over there. And, that's the way we did it. I mean,
just came.
The ideas hung on what they're talking, you know, but it's one of those things where you'd say the scene carries the shot or the shot carries the scene. We're not pressing an issue here, you know, so let's just do it this way. Or you could get a cut of her like this, doing that. You can get a cut of him coming out the door and all the way down the steps and back to her doing this. And then, but you don't have the same kind of magic in the scene.
Right.
Yeah.
Which there is magic in that scene, for sure.
Yeah.
Just on the subject of working with Woody Allen directly, you know, I mean, very few people in the history of cinema have achieved what he's achieved.
Right.
I believe he was quoted as saying once that he really didn't understand photography that much until he met you.
Right.
And, you know, you look at his films, you know, Bananas, Sleeper, the earlier films, you know, of course, which are made fun of in Stardust Memories,
right,
where he says, you know, we like your earlier funny films.
Right.
They are, you know, basically gag films. You know, Take the Money and Run as a gag film, right? You go from joke to joke to joke, and they're brilliant jokes.
Right.
And then in Love and Death, all of a sudden, which I don't think you shot, all of a sudden he starts to use the camera in a more meaningful way, for lack of better words.
Right.
What was that relationship like? How did you, I mean, did he look up to you? Did he, like, how did it?
Well, when we met, you know, we started working together. I mean, that's when I started blocking for him, you know. Discussing the way scenes could play in a room, you know, this any suggestion about how, if you look at those movies, the way they move along and how he presents himself in and out of rooms and things, it was all the suggestions I gave him based on the blocking, you know, about how you should play a scene. See, before that, he would admit the fact that, you know, I just like to put the camera up and then I stand out front and we do it, you know.
Right.
Whereas blocking and a camera becomes an instrument of telling the story.
Right.
It's not simply, you know, the other way. So we began to understand that, and the use of close-ups and the use of no close-up and the use of two shots and that's it. And the use of, so, but it was all based also on, you make that choice because what's the cut before this and what's the cut after that? What are you going to do before? And we'll go, it's like he'd come over with a script and say, what about this thing or thing? And I turn the page. He says, no, back here. I said, I know that, but I just want to see what comes after this. I just want to see what comes after this,
so
this piece.
That you were looking at flow from the macro perspective.
Yeah.
Okay,
and you have to. Yeah, the whole movie in your head all at the same time, plus what's going on at the moment, you know. So blocking is extremely important when you're making a movie, because you want it to deliver information. And you want it to make in the shortest possible way, in the most effective way. So look at a lot of movies now. Nobody knows how to block. I mean, they don't know. Yeah. So
it's fascinating because it's so fundamental. I mean, blocking, you know, it's a stage term, you know.
Yeah,
so,
right.
So fundamental to...
Well, camera blocking, you know, I'd get the scene, there were three cuts, okay. I'd lay all three cuts down, mark all the actors, send the actors away. And then I'd light primarily for most of it, except for the...
Little things.
Little things.
Would you put in lights, you know, take two, take three, in between takes, just start putting things in, or would you wait for them to come back and do the scene again?
No, I was finished. They'd come back and sit down, and we'd have a tech rehearsal just for the sound people and everything, and then shoot. The close-up, then I'd make things, adjustments for the close-up or whatever, if necessary, I don't know.
You go to make Manhattan, and then later Stardust Memories, and they're very different looking films.
Right.
You know, they're both black and white, but that the similarities kind of end there.
Right.
Well, maybe there's some more, you know. But,
yeah, right.
You know, at the beginning of Stardust, you know, there's Woody Allen is stuck on the Bergman train, and he wants to be on the Fellini train.
Yeah, right.
He's on the loser train, and a very young Sharon Stone, I think, blows him a kiss through the window.
Yeah, right.
You know,
yeah, right.
At that point, who is she?
Right.
And was that completely conscious? You're going to make one look like Bergman and one look like Fellini, and you're going to use those things through? No, not even. It was just about the scene.
Not even close.
I mean,
not to me. I mean, in his head, it might have been going around that way. But he never, ever had any discussion about what something looked like in somebody else's movie with me, ever.
Ever.
And I never related to anyone else's movie. I just did what I thought
was right.
And then people would rush and say, gee, this is a very Bergman-esque thing. And I said, oh, no. I said, but none of this had anything to do with it.
So then, if that's the case, let me go back to something you said when you said The Godfather, you know, 20 minutes before you start shooting, you make this snap decision.
Right.
This is what the movie's going to look like.
Yeah.
Is it obviously, if you're worried about, if you as a cinematographer are thinking about cutting, about pace, about rhythm and release and flow, and you're thinking about the layout of the camera, all you're essentially thinking completely visually and structurally about this movie, which is inspiring to hear, by the way.
Right.
At what point do you say, oh yeah, but I got to give it a consistent look, and that consistent look is based on blank? I mean, is there any thought to that, or is it just, you know, you're shooting on one film stock and you hope everything kind of works together? No,
I mean, I always decide whether it's going to be, how consistent it's going to be. Always. I mean, because I don't, unless something is designed to be different for some particular reason, it's part of the design of the movie. But generally speaking, I make a decision to shoot a movie in a certain way, it's the same from the beginning to the end. I mean, I don't generally jump around with, you know.
Why is it that in the 50s and 60s, movie heading into the 70s, really?
Yeah.
I mean, I think 1968 is kind of the year the cinema changed.
Yeah.
But that it was so common to see very stagey lighting and, you know, basically triple shadows and quadruple shadows. And, you know, an example I've used previously is, you know, The Great Escape. It's a wonderful, wonderful movie.
Yeah,
I can watch it 100 times. But, you know, they walk into these cabins to confront the Germans and, you know, like there's shadows everywhere.
Right.
It just looks like they're on a set.
Right.
What changed that got rid of that aesthetic? Was it just advancements in technology and film stocks getting faster? Or was it...
I changed a lot of it.
Well, thank you for answering that. But by the way, Gordon Willis, I changed that.
I really changed a lot of it.
So
well, I did. I took things out of the key light, fill light thinking kind of thing. You know, I never really thought about the scene, a lot of these people. A lot of people did, and they did the best they could. And a lot of them did a really good job with it, actually, for the most part. But most of the thinking was, well, you know, this is so-and-so. She's so-and-so's in it, and then Steve is in it, and so-and-so's in it. So their first obligation, and this wasn't something, even if maybe if they thought about it, they didn't do it anyway. Their first obligation was first not to get fired, but the first obligation was to the studio to do things in a certain way that was acceptable. Applicable, acceptable, always the same, and why don't I look nice today, and you know, all that kind of crap.
So is it safe to say that the thing that the studio finds acceptable at the end of the day is based on, to be blunt about it, a male phallic insecurity, more is better, bigger is better.
Yeah, sure.
Throw up more, and I know it's good.
Yeah, you know? A lot of it is that. A lot of it. And then, of course, you're dealing with contracts, you know, people, stars, you know, like Joan Crawford, you know, I dragged this cameraman around with her for a long time so she could look a certain way. And there was a funny story about her in the screening room after a day's work with him. And she's saying, I forget his name. Anyway, she says, Joe, I'm not looking so good now. And the cameraman says, well, I'm getting older. You know, so I couldn't even. Now, there is a limit. You're not a plastic surgeon. You know, you can only do something.
I'm getting older.
Yeah. But the bottom line of it is, I mean that I changed it because I started redefining things based on what the story was, what was happening in the room. Plus, I looked at something. I thought, this is a nice way to do it. It had nothing to do with some
preconceived notion.
No. I thought, this is a good way to do it. But it was always hung on, but is it okay for you know, this story? Or is it okay for this moment in this story? So I never thought, oh, yeah, let's put a 10K over here and the same thing. And I put plenty of 10Ks up for a lot of stuff, but not in the same way. So
let's talk about going right down the path of saying we can get away with this and we can get away with that and we can do it. So two things to ask about The Godfather Part Two. There's one sequence, Pacino standing in a room with a mantle. And I think you were quoted as saying, I may have went too far, but that's okay because Rembrandt went too far a couple times.
I have said that stupidly. I may have said that, but
no, I don't think it's stupid.
That was with a scene with Morgana King when he comes back to see his mother in a winter in the house there. And actually, see, one of the problems, well, what's happened a lot, technically speaking now, is what's happened is, first of all, Eastman Kodak can't make film anymore because they don't want to make film anymore.
Right.
But even when they were making it late in the I always depended on repeatability. They made film stocks on a given way, and that was it. If I ordered something there, I always knew I was going to get that. Repeatability in labs was much better. That got really dicey after a while. And then the film got really dicey after a while. So you have all this crap going, you know, that you couldn't really define. Well, when I did a lot of those scenes, they were three strips. You know, they were printing three strip prints, Technicolor prints. So a black on a three strip print was black, you know, and you could take a thin line on the screen and you had it. You know, I mean, it was beautiful, actually. And your movie would look the same all over the world because they'd same matrixes go to Rome, London, and they print, and they'd have the same thing. Later, which Paramount took the Golden Goose and just wrung it and told, you know, there was nothing left of it. It was
talking about the
original negatives, right, instead of it. Then they didn't save the matrix. They lost the separations. It was like, you know, bunch of guys cutting coats.
So when you sat down to retime it for the Blu-ray,
all of that stuff. Well, the Blu-ray, luckily, a lot of stuff was saved because electronically, because they had damaged so much negative memory. But anyway, removing three-strip printing from the process made it more difficult to get what they originally looked like. And even dealing with these people later to electronically reestablish the movies, I still didn't get it back again.
Never got
back to the you know, the yellow thing. Yeah, it's there, but it's not there the way it was. So it's very difficult. Then they sold the those three movies the two movies anyway, the first two, to the networks to make a thing, and the networks just did what they want. You know, it's like. And I don't know what Francis was doing, sipping drinks in the Bahamas or something, but because he never really, you know, was like...
That yeah. bum.
So the bottom line, you know, is you can't always, you know, depend on anything anymore. And I depended on a lot of repeatability.
Right.
Later on, before I stopped shooting, I began to not depend on it anymore because things, I'd start doing things that were a little more bulletproof because I knew that Charlie, well, you know, was on the developing things and drinking coffee and making phone calls at the same time. So I, you know, realized there was had to be something done.
So this, you're talking essentially about the a little bit of erosion in quality in the business.
Oh yeah, no question of it. And I and it happened, you know. And of course, well, anyway, I don't want to go into the,
no, but it is. Yeah. So let's talk. You talked a bit, a little bit about yeah. Okay. Sorry, should we start again?
Yeah, switch cards.
Perfect. Let's switch cards. Are you available to be a grandfather for hire, or no?
For who?
Well,
no, you just don't.
No, you don't want him for that. So that is so they really the quality in labs really went down.
Oh, it went way down actually, and also you know, Eastman. I had friends at Eastman who would do what I asked for a while, but. You know, you'd finish a movie and then they'd change the positive, the formula on the positive that you've been using.
Why would they change it?
Because they wanted to make another positive. So you'd start printing the movie on the on what you thought was the same positive. They'd made changes, so it didn't look the same.
Didn't look the same.
So I raised hell about it on one movie. I forget which one. Anyway, they came down and they said, well, it's only just a matter of turning a valve. We can put it back to weight. I said, well, then turn the valve. I said, you can't just... arbitrary, or they used to make changes right in the middle of a movie towards the end. They'd make
you'd be shooting, you'd be getting dailies, and they'd make changes.
Yeah, they make changes in the positive.
Are we talking like around the days of like Devil's Own and Malice and stuff like that?
Yeah, probably Malice. Yeah, in that era before that, actually, they even started change the positive, and then they started off with a certain negative. And I said, well, can you deliver enough? Because I'd order the whole movie on one number, you know. So the negative was the same. And they start off and then cut the negative off. They didn't have any more after, you know. So they weren't, I got stung a couple of times by Kodak because they didn't really, they weren't all that reliable, finally. They're very corporate, but they were
okay.
They were kind of not good at them. But I had, as I said, I had a couple of friends who were very good, uh-huh. were helpful. But as a corporation, yeah.
It's interesting to hear because it sounds like it was just a source of frustration at the end.
Yeah,
of the
day. Right.
That's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
Let's talk about a bit about Francis Ford Coppola. I mean, yeah. you described the relationship with Woody Allen very well.
Yeah.
How did you meet, and how did, and was it the same exact thing with Francis, where you were, if I may call him Francis, Mr.
Yeah.
Coppola,
yeah.
where you were really guiding and advising in terms of what essentially amounts to cutting?
Well, we didn't have the same kind of the same kind of discussions and the ones I did with Woody are really, they were very quick and on our feet. They weren't the in-depth thinking. They were just like bang, 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 you like this, you don't like it, boom, boom, and it was fine. Francis is a different kind of person, you know, and I think he did a wonderful job of extracting Godfather 1 from the book. Because the book wasn't as good as the movie, in my opinion. So, I mean, mm-hmm. he mounted what was good about the book on the screen. I give him huge credit for that. We didn't always get along because I deal in specifics. You know, I don't want to know about feelings or things. I deal in specifics. You got feelings, I want to know, you know. So... And I deal in, you know, layouts. You can't shoot unless you block a scene. You can't, you know, you have to know what you're doing.
Right.
So I was very instrumental in doing that all the time. And it was very frustrating to Francis, who sort of like, oh, let's jump in a car and go shoot him running around the field. So he still had this kind of film school thing.
Mentality.
Right. Good writer, but still, and he'll admit to it. He's like, you know, he still wants to run a studio and a film school. But, so we had a lot of problems that way.
Is there any advantage to having it, that sort of like, you know, free fall mentality to shooting? I mean, can it work for some pictures? Or, I mean, obviously it has in the past. There's got to be some pictures that you like that have.
It can work for some pictures, but yeah. It can't work for those kind of pictures, the one that he was shooting. It had a lyric kind of narrative about it, and it had to be structured, and you had to shoot it, and you had to be able to cut it, and blah, 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 and all the rest of it, you see. But, I mean, if he saw Marlon Brando standing in the corner all made up as the Don scratching his ass, he'd want to rush over there and shoot it, you know. Well, I'm afraid not.
Right.
You know,
right.
Set it up and we'll shoot it, you know, but...
Couple of sequences I'd like to bring up that still to this day I think they're just so engrossing.
Yeah.
And your discussion already about the nature of cutting and blocking answered a lot of it. But the hospital sequence when Michael Corleone is trying to protect his father and moving the bed and hiring you know, his compatriot to stand there like he has a gun when he doesn't.
Yeah.
The shootouts in The Devil's Own, you know, that take place early on in the movie.
Right.
There's some shootouts which are, you know, very kind of like you're not sure what's going on, but you follow everything so clearly.
Right. Right.
Another moment from The Devil's Own, and I'm sure this probably isn't brought up a lot, but how did you deal with the fact that, you know, Brad Pitt's character staying in the semi-finished basement and he hides the documents or whatever it is, the microfilm, the money, whatever, the kid, under the subfloor of the bathroom.
Right.
And it's completely clear what he's doing.
Right.
And it's completely clear that Harrison Ford would stumble upon it.
Right.
And yet this is something that if I read it in the script, I would think, like, how are you going to show that? I mean, you're talking about a subfloor of a bait, you know. Like,
right.
You know?
Well,
and there's no close-ups either.
Right. Well, there is one that goes down and digs out the floor a little bit, I think. But the bottom line of it is, it's, again, how you think something out. I mean, how do you present this so everybody knows what's going
on? What's going on?
I mean, it's that simple. I mean, it's not that simple to come up with a solution sometimes, but if you don't get it right when you think it out, I mean, if you know, you know, then, you know,
it's the same thing.
It's a lack of definition. I said, you know, this doesn't have enough definition. Nobody's going to know what the hell you're doing. I told him, we were setting up, when Brad first arrived at Harrison's house, gets out of the car and the gun and thing, walks up the porch and then looks in the window, and there is Harrison on the couch. Well, nobody knows what that is. So I told Pakula, I said, you know, you better sit down with this paper and, you know, and sort of put it up. So when we're looking there, I said, no one is going to know what the hell he's looking at because this is just, you don't know what that is. Well, no, he didn't want to do it. So nobody knows what he's looking at, you know. And so he tells me, he says, I looked at this for 6 weeks. I didn't know what the hell was going on. I said, I told you. I said,
you know, did you go back and shoot the...
No, it's in there. But, but you know, it's one of those things. Wishing something is going to change in your head, you know, when you know that it's not going to be, it won't work, you know.
Right.
So don't...
The IBD, the internal bullshit detector.
Yeah, yeah. You're there. You know, it's 5 minutes. Just do it.
Just cut the shot.
Yeah, right.
And working with Alan J. Pakula. Pakula, okay.
Yeah, right.
That was, I mean, you're talking about a director that made some tremendous thrillers with you.
Yeah.
All the President's Men, a thriller with very few guns.
Right.
You know, and a lot of name giving.
Right.
Woodward, Bernstein. It's riveting from beginning to end.
It is. Still.
It still is riveting. Yeah. And how much of it is about those long, 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 you were talking about you lit with fluorescence. I mean, what about that movie works for you? I mean, obviously the story, but I'm saying, what about your work in it?
I'm very proud of that movie because every now and then I put it on and I can't see much. No, anyway, but I put it on. But the bottom line of it is, the reason I'm proud of it is, it's all about delivering information. And I thought this movie doesn't end soon. I'm going to go nuts because every shot, in principle, you were delivering information. You had to be delivering information. And when you look at it, we did a damn fine job of doing that and not make it
obvious
or rudimentary in some way. We kept it, you know, the structure and the shot structure on it.
Can you give an example of once it was, which is a piece of information and a piece of information?
Well, I can't because I can't remember all the information in it. But the bottom line of it is this scene where they're all trying to find out about this thing, and they finally rush to the elevator and tell Jason blah blah blah, and he says, "Okay, go ahead and print it." Pasting all that together—that's another bad place to work in this newsroom because that got really bit oppressive. I don't know how anybody works in fluorescence all day long, but it was just it was a juxtaposition of imagery became very important, the size of the imagery, what you cut to, what you didn't cut to, and still be able to, you know, deliver the information.
Right.
Also, at that time, you couldn't interlock on a video screen. We had these damn things all over the place. We had a way of syncing up so that we could bring the line down to almost nothing. And when you looked at it, you didn't really deal with the, you know.
The line of, I'm sorry.
Well, there's a scan line there that you could never get rid of if you just photographed tubes. You know,
I see.
You can fix it. You plug it in and it all goes away.
Just paint it out, yeah.
Not at that point. So we had to always deal with that whenever there was a monitor in a shot. And they were all over the place, you know, so.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
And the other thing about the movie was... said to Alan, I said, you know, this feels like an in-depth movie to me because this newsroom and everything that you have to see. You see a lot of things going on at the same time.
Yes.
So it seems like an in-depth movie.
Did you use a split diopter at any point?
Right. So I had some diopters built, actually, for that movie.
Oh, really?
And I had a holder built for them so they could be slid in and out during a shot. So the guy said, geez, you can't do that. I said, I'm going to. So...
But just so you know, folks, Al back here laughed, chuckled on that one. Well, I'm going to.
So we had scenes, you know, we're moving around the room and go this way, go that way, have marks on them, just slide them in. You didn't see it. And I had a shot on Bob on the telephone. He was making this long call with a lot of stuff going on in the background there. And that's where I actually had a bill for. And we're zooming in on them like this. So and it just... calibrated so they were moving this in at the same time in order to maintain the focus on both ends. You
know? Wow.
You know, the second assistant who, that was the dumb side of the lens, he had to, you know, push it in on Mark and the other assistant to take care of the focus. He didn't show up that they had to make that shot. He got scared that he wouldn't be able to do it. I did it.
You did it.
I did it. I did the diopter and I fired him, but he couldn't. This is a Hollywood kid, you know. His brain was not.
was Gordon Willis tough to work for, or was he easy to work for?
I mean, easy as long as you do your work.
Right.
I'm pretty easy to work for, actually.
Well, you said earlier you don't want to know about feelings. You don't want to know someone's scared or feeling something.
Well, sure I do. If they're upset about something, I don't want them to be upset about it. I mean, that shot in the Library of Congress with Dustin and Bob going through all of those things, you know. Alan and I were trying to figure out what to do with this thing. And I said, well, you know, needle in a haystack. So we start right there. And then so we came up with the idea, how the hell do we do that? But if you go into the library, you look up at the dome. It's a dome, you know.
Yep.
And it can actually get up in there. So we put a winch up in there with a cable on it and an Aeroflex with a stabilizer on it. And we just started, you know, lifting the thing. It's a thing. So we just...
Right, the brilliance. Yeah, this is what they're going to have to search through.
So
right.
We did it, and unfortunately I had to do it twice because we didn't have any video then. So I had to figure it out on a piece of paper and then use taglines to fix it as it was going up.
Fixing, you mean focus or?
No, the focus, we had radio focus for it, but to move the camera, because it was not dead center, it had to move off this way. So we did it twice, and the second time was pretty good. It might have been better if we could have actually gone up a little bit faster, but if we'd used the whole move and tote, you know, we'd have been sitting there for 20 minutes, which was not good. But so we put a dissolve in the middle of it to
Well, it's a beautiful shot.
But it worked.
It worked beautifully.
It worked
beautifully. I was mentioning it before, but I just want to come back to it. Going down the path of how far can we go with what you were doing with light and with framing and interiors.
Uh-huh.
Some of this movie is like it's stunning. There's no person in the world.
I'm glad you like it. That's great.
It's a stunning film. It is so innovative and there's other Hannah and Her Sisters is a relatable film. There's other film. There's other Woody Allen films that are relatable, but this was truly a tremendous achievement. Was part of you scared a little bit about going that far down the dim line? No.
Well, one of the things you learn,
because the latitude of the stocks back then was like...
Yeah, but I know what they were.
Right.
And one of the problems is everybody's guessing with what... one of the first things I did is I pick a stock to shoot the movie with, right?
Right.
Okay, I shoot this series of tests on this stock. Which ran from normal all the way down to three stops under and three stops over. Anyway, to make a long story short, you find out what the limits of the film stock are that you're, and the limits of the print stock you are, and that's how you calculate something. You have to know what a stop and a half under looks like on the screen when you do it, because you can't tell when you're standing there.
Right.
It's your problem is you're... Your eyes make adjustment. They compensate for it. Film does it. You have to make it do what you want. So if you don't know how to make it do what you want, then blah. So it's the same thing with all low key or high key or normal. You have to know what it's going to look like if you underexpose it by 2 or 1 or don't or normal or whatever you do to it. So
fabulous.
Bottom line is
that's fabulous.
It's that.
Did you ever get fired off a job?
I quit off a job, actually, but I never got fired off a job.
Uh-huh.
I'm happy to say that.
Yeah.
But I never got fired off.
See, I was hoping the answer was going to be yes, that happened once, and all the cinematographers watching this young, old, whatever, would go, even Gordon Willis, but no, Gordon Willis did not get fired.
No, I didn't know. But no, I never did. I was very fortunate, actually. In fact, when I think about it, I worked with very difficult people, but I was difficult myself. But I think they were all very good people, very nice people, very crafted people. They were all, and they were very receptive.
To your ideas.
To our ideas. And because they weren't arbitrary. They had to do with making his script better or making it easier to do or making it blah, 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 So it was never something, well, you got to do it this way or whatever. It wasn't that. It was just, what do you think of? Present things two or three ways or one way, two ways,
Any regrets?
No, I don't think so. I think the only regret I have is that maybe it could have lasted longer, but not really. I don't know.
Well, let's talk about that, because I was going to say, you did something which is very atypical, which is that, most cinematographers, at least within the last 30 years, they sort of get viewed as peaking in their 50s, for whatever that means. They can do beautiful work in their 20s. They can do amazing work.
Right.
And then they sort of ride that wave as one of the sort of the old guard, while new kids are considered new fresh, into their 70s, right? And then sometimes they for whatever reason bow out or whatever, You, Mr. Willis, sort of said, 64, 65, I don't know the exact age, but you went, I'm done. See you later.
Well, I was done, actually. I got tired of waiting in the rain for actors to come out of their trailers. I really got tired of all that. And then you run out of people.
Right.
The kind of directors who, have an elegant head on them and know how to tell stories, they began to die or disappear or quit.
Right.
And then you can work if you want to. But if that's the essence of your day, it's not good.
Screw it.
Yeah, so I don't. So I just didn't. It wasn't there anymore. So I figured, well, it's been good anyway.
Yeah, got so. It. Well, it was a graceful end to a tremendous, tremendous career.
Yeah, great.
One other question for you. Was there any films that you made that you're particular, not that you're not proud of, but you go, I just don't like this movie very much?
I answer
you
that.
You don't have to answer that.
I answer that question all the way. There's like moments in every movie I've shot that I really enjoy.
Uh-huh.
Because, I don't know, you can't be 100%. You know, it's like, you just can't. And compromise has a lot to do with it when you're making movies, too. You know, oh, all right, let's get on with it because nobody's going to get this the way, you know, so let's just compromise and move on. So there's always certain sections in movies where that's there, you know.
So even for you, there's sections in movie, even some of the great ones where you go, yeah, we just had to.
Right. And then there's weakness in your own capabilities when you're working too. You'll get tired or you'll say, I'm not moving this. I'm not rigging this. You know why? Because I don't know how. This is what you're talking to yourself about. It'll be okay this way, you know. But if it had been at 10 o'clock the morning before, I would have done it another way, you know. So a lot of that happens too. So those moments are strung around. Not that they're bad moments. They're just not as good as they should be, you know, or as good as they could be.
This is probably how long is a piece of string question, so it may not have a useful answer.
Yeah.
But if you were shooting today,
yeah,
what, you know, obviously the clear-cut answer is they're all just tools. All these lens sets and cameras and everything are all just tools. What would you be shooting on today if you were shooting?
I honestly don't know because I never picked anything when I was shooting. I'd pick things based on, I mean, I had a certain Cameron's things, but I would usually pick things based on what it was I needed to tell a story or to do it.
Right.
You know, if I needed this, I'd get that done. Or if I needed that, I'd get that, you know.
Right.
So I never really was hung up on any particular
film stock, lens.
No, nothing. It just depended on what would do the job. And if that worked then. And then sort of when I was done, it was like, boom, it went right out of my head. So not my structure and my capability of functioning, but those moments, you know, I didn't deal with them anymore. So,
do you have any favorite? I mean, were you a wide lens guy? Were you a long lens guy? That just matter on the moment.
I was a 40mm person, actually. In fact, Panavision made one for me because they had, like, you know, they'd go from 28 to 35 to some other obscure thing. I said, no, you know, I step into a room, a 40 is perfect. I mean, it's like it looks very normal on the screen.
Right.
Normal. I said, that's what I write. So I've always seen everything. It's
can
sort
we make
of,
sure that's at 40?
Yeah,
sure
right. 40.
You're on 40.
Are you? That's very funny. 150. Yeah, right. That's good, too. But
he threw you a bone.
40 is, you know, it's a normal. You look at it on the screen, it's, you know, you're not pushing anybody. You're not pulling anybody. It's, you know, it's there. I'm a sort of an eye level person. I see movies like eye level. Yeah, people, eye level. That's sort of how I see it.
Were you inspired when you saw Tokyo Story for the first time and Ozu's doing the camera at knee height because the character's kneeling? Or?
No. I just perceive things at eye level. I thought if somebody walked into a room and said, what, the way that we get up in the corner and we look down, and my first question is, why are you doing that?
Right. Whereas in the example of the Hoffman, Redford going craning up in the
right.
library, there was a reason for it because
right.
you wanted to show just what they were
right.
as opposed
right.
to, you know, like, well, why don't we just shoot from up high?
Right.
So you were a 40mm guy. Any things you passed on that you wish you hadn't have passed on that you were offered that you went, I should have taken that?
There are several, but I can't remember what they were. But there were one or two I think I should have done, actually, but I didn't do it. I was always saying, the other thing I love was stories about the German stories and Nazis and all that kind of stuff, World War II. But I never had an opportunity to do. I always wanted to make a German movie, but everybody else was having that opportunity to make these kind of movies. But I found it more kind of interesting. I always kind of, but I never had I was not in the right place for journalism. Well, I was finally. I was in and out of California a lot, but they had stopped making those kind of movies by the time I came along.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have liked to. Yeah.
Interesting.
I like walk and talk movies. Mostly is what I did. I'd call them walk and talk movies. Mm-hmm.
Well, there was some significant action.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Sure. No question. But they're
Yeah. Phenomenal dialogue. I'm just going to play a little Audible Rorschach. DD2.
Yeah, if you want to keep going. Yeah.
Sure. I'll just, five more minutes.
Stop and start.
Sure. Yeah, okay.
Just stop and start.
Yeah, sure. Stop. Walk and talk movies. I like that a lot.
That's how I see things, It's like not...
How did you, just as a side point, how did you shoot that shot of Mo Green getting shot through the eye? Was that, because you can't, it literally looks like he's getting shot. Like, it's one of the most profound special effects ever. And
yeah, that guy was one of the best effects people in the business. He did a lot of great stuff. Let me see, Mo. That happened on the back of the glasses, I believe.
Because it cracks and then blood just...
Yeah, it happened on... He had it rigged from the back of the glasses.
Uh-huh.
But don't... I can't give you a drawing of it because I don't remember anything. But it happened... He had it rigged all in the back of the glasses.
Amazing.
Up in there.
So I want to play some Audible Rorschach with you. I'll give you a name. You give me your thought. And this may be unfair. You may say... Glickman, forget it. I'm not doing this. But
well, let's see what you're doing first.
Thoughts. Conrad Hall, Sr.
A very, very good DP. A nice person.
Roger Deakins.
I don't know Roger, but I think he's very good as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Vittorio Storaro.
I know Vittorio. I like Vittorio. And he's also done some beautiful work, although I can't understand what he's saying half the time because it's very tangled up in a lot of talk, but they're very good.
The late, having recently passed, as we say in Hebrew, Olav Shalom, Harris Savides.
Good, actually. Good. Good work.
Yeah.
Take that one. Good one.
Well, from Gordon Willis, that means a lot.
Yeah, right.
He also said the same thing to Al at one point.
That's right.
Yeah. I can't thank you enough for your time.
Yeah, right, my pleasure.
It's inspiring to hear your words, hear your thoughts.
All right. Well, I hope you have enough drabble in there to put something.
Do you think there's enough to cut together there? And
I guess. Yeah.
Should we rearrange the blocking at all? Or
No. Just a lot of dissolves, that's all. Get through it.
If you can't solve, dissolve?
Yeah, dissolve. Exactly. They work.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank
welcome.
You for having us.
Yeah, sure. Delighted.
Pleasure to meet you.
He didn't eat any donuts.
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
Wow, that was great.
So you have to drive to New York now?